Hey Fixers, we've got a special treat for you this week. Students from the University of Oregon's Clark Honors College will be joining us as guest hosts to interview luminaries from around the state of Oregon who are working on innovative fixes in our state. Without further ado, here's the episode.
This is Fix It. I'm your guest host, Nathaniel.
And I'm the other guest host, Nathan. We are juniors at the Clark Honors College at the University of Oregon. I'm majoring in math and computer science.
And I'm majoring in political science. Kevin and Nishant were gracious enough to allow us to guest host their podcast, and we are thrilled to be doing so.
Today, we're fixing how we view trade-offs in public policy with Jeff Goodman, Lake Oswego City Councilor and two-time Republican candidate for Oregon State Treasurer. Jeff comes from a background in finance. He earned an MBA in finance and management from the Wharton School of Business before working as a financial analyst and treasurer for organizations such as Hyster, Oregon Natural Gas, and even USA Olympic Swimming. During his time on city council, he gained a reputation as a devoted advocate of fiscal responsibility. He's particularly proud of the fact that during his time on council, Lake Oswego was able to rebuild the operations and maintenance center, the city hall, and the police station, all without raising taxes.
Today, Jeff seeks to advocate for an approach to public policy that accounts for the limited resources at the state's disposal. In his words, if we do this, what don't we do?
Hi, Jeff. Happy to have you here.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
So usually on this show, the hosts ask their guest for a specific problem and a solution. But the problem you're passionate about, interestingly, has to do with how we solve problems, particularly how governmental officials viewed the solutions to the problems before them. Can you tell us a little more about that?
You bet. There's two elements to that. First and foremost, acknowledge the facts, however uncomfortable they may be. They're stubborn things. Secondly, is when projects, go awry. I'm a very big believer, because of my educational background, business background, and just life in general, acknowledging that when somebody says, let's do this, you also have to be asking the question, if we do this, what don't we do? That question doesn't get asked very often of, if we do this, what don't we do? And if we do this, what are we telling the people who were supposed to go next that they're not, their project has now been moved back? That's what I call leading with integrity, being accountable, and asking the right questions. If you do that, you're going to get good outcomes.
So why would you say this view continues to be such a major issue today? Or rather, why does it persist in government? Could you walk us through a history of it, maybe? Do you think it's been around for a long time, or is it more of a recent development?
No, I think it's been around a long time. I think it's just part of human nature. Because when you ask the question, if we do this, what don't we do? You're saying, having to say in an indirect way, no to something. And if you're in elected office and you want to stay in elected office, saying no to somebody is not something that gets you votes. Saying yes to somebody is what gets you votes. So you have to be willing to just simply say what you think, why you think. And I call that the politics of persuasion, featuring open minds, a conversational tone. And this may be a more recent development. I don't think so. I think we hear about it more, and we hear about it faster, but I don't think it's changed. But the politics too often appears to me to be heavy on assertion, light on explanation, and bereft of persuasion. But to have that, you need to have conversations with people.
One thing we're wondering is, how can this mindset of not being able to say no to things be addressed? What's the general approach to remedying this?
One is, you always got to do your homework. So when it comes to an example on the budget issues, you've got to have a good understanding of the budget. Whether you're a numbers person or not, take the time to learn the budget. A specific example, and this was when I was serving on the council. And during the budget process, which is once every year or once every 2 years, there was a resident of the city who came forward and said, we need to do a pathway between point A and point B. And one of the members on the budget committee, also a member of the council, said, let's jump on it. Let's do this. And there was some conversation around that. And then I got recognized. I said, okay, it's a good project. It's number 75 on our list of 150 pathway projects. So if we take this project and move it up to the first project, or move it up on the list of projects to do, of pathways, which pathway are you going to take off the list? And the conversation ended. After a while, my colleagues knew that I was going to be asking this kind of question all the time. So they started saying, okay, I want to take this project off the list. Here's why I want to take it off the list. And here's what I'm going to tell people who are going to be impacted by that. That's a much more productive conversation.
Do you think that's an effective way for everyone to reach their goals? Is it kind of like an everyone wins situation? Or is it being comfortable with those kinds of trade-offs?
You bet. One is being comfortable with those kind of trade-offs. Number two, I'm a big believer in a win is where everybody gets something and nobody gets everything.
Along with viewing solutions as trade-offs, when faced with the reality that we're not going to be able to do everything, how do you figure out what is the best thing to do? How do you weigh those priorities?
I'll give a general answer. I'll give a specific answer. The general answer is you have to first know yourself. What's really important to you? What are your red lines? When I was serving on council, we were trying to figure out a way to rebuild our city hall and police station. And the primary financing technique for it was the use of urban renewal financing. And I will spare you and your listeners a long conversation about the merits or non-merits of urban renewal financing. It's a great financing tool. The goal of that particular financing tool to rebuild the city hall and the police station is to be meant primarily for public-private partnerships. You know, we'll build a parking lot and we'll public parking lot, we'll have it surrounded by office or retail, public-private, to help benefit the downtown or the area that you are. Well, some of my colleagues on council were reluctant, had significant concerns about using urban renewal financing to pay entirely for a new city hall and police station without having any private part in it. So there was lots of conversations which occurred over an extended period of time. And as it turned out, the solution emerged from those conversations where there were a couple of organizations in our city. One is called Bookteque, which is a volunteer organization that takes in books when people get rid of books for whatever reasons. Bookteque takes these books, cleans them up, puts them up for sale, and then makes a contribution to the library. And another organization, which was the Arts Council. So the idea emerged, well, what if we put those two organizations on the first floor of the new city hall facing out onto the primary thoroughfare to activate the pedestrians, to bring in people, et cetera. And a couple of members were saying, yeah, I think I can live with that. I'd like to have more, but if we can get that in, yeah, I can support urban renewal financing. Now the trade-off was that's going to mean less space for city hall employees and for the police. So you go back and you talk with the staff and say, well, can you live with this with 5,000 square feet less or whatever the number was? And you have those conversations. And out of that, it emerged, we can make this work. And when the financing question came up, it was approved 7-0.
I would like to go a bit more into your experience working in Lake Oswego. You've worked on a lot of projects. It actually says on your website, in your own words, you were able to rebuild the operations and maintenance center, the city hall, and the police station, all without raising a single dime. Would you say this is a demonstration of how this philosophy of viewing solutions as trade-offs could be used in practice?
Yes. The trade-off, let's do the police or the city hall and police station. The trade-off was by using urban renewal financing to do that, it exhausted that tool for other projects. And on the operations and maintenance center, that was a project that was done by getting money from a lot of different sources from within the city. There was no one source that did it. It's an approach. I mean, my default mode, and if you will, is always live within your means first.
I'm interested in hearing more in on whether you think there's a difference between implementing this particular fix in Lake Oswego versus implementing it in Salem. Rather, is there a difference in how we have to work to solve this problem at a state versus a local level?
Yes. In theory, there is no difference. In city council, you have seven. And granted, Lake Oswego is a fortunate city. I can't sit here and say it isn't, okay? But the principles still apply. Statewide, you've got a legislature with 60 representatives, 30 senators, then the executive branch. But the same principles apply. Asking the questions, knowing the numbers, building the relationships, and looking at trade-offs. With 90 people, it is definitely harder. And 90 people plus, you know, the five statewide elected offices, you know, governor, secretary of state, treasurer, attorney general, and the head of Bureau of Labor Industry.
Yeah, it's hard to take everyone out for drinks in that case, but the principle does remain the same, you would argue.
And you work at it. You have to have people willing to work at it. You need to have Republicans saying, okay, I've generally got a pretty good idea what other Republicans are thinking. Okay, so I'm going to spend more time reaching out to Democrats because one, I might be wrong. And two, if I'm not wrong, I might be able to persuade them. And Democrats need to spend more, they generally have a pretty good idea of what other Democrats think. And that's not to say that Republicans or Democrats, you know, have a unified view on the issues. They don't. But then reach out. Democrats spend more time reaching out to Republicans. As an example, I mean, if I had been the treasurer, been elected treasurer, well, I would have been the only Republican statewide. But you know, I would have, one of the first things I would wanted to do would be to reach out to Speaker Tina Kotek, Senate President Peter Courtney, Governor Brown, and say, "Hey," and this would start the day after the election. Let's have lunch, and we'll talk about anything other than politics. And I have a track record of doing that. For what it's worth, I did that here in the city. After every election, before the election would happen, I've had a pattern of always inviting all the candidates for office for a potluck dinner. I do the invite in October and say, we're going to have a potluck dinner in January. I'll host it. I'll do the entree. And we'll figure out what everybody else is going to bring. Bring your spouse, bring your significant other, come by yourself. And the only rule that we're going to have over the course of our get together potluck dinner is you can talk about anything that you want other than LO politics. And it's just a way of fostering that. And it's people remember that.
Yeah, I think that's a worthy goal. It'd be nice to see that on a large scale, I think. Just kind of to wrap us up, you know, a lot of our listeners aren't exactly embedded in the fabric of government. What are some ways the average citizen could work to achieve this goal in their less explicitly political lives?
Certainly. And I completely agree with you. Most people, you know, don't follow local government until it impacts them. But I have found, at least in Oregon, our legislators are remarkably open to hearing from individuals, the city council in particular, but also at the state legislative level. So what the average citizen can do is number one, just simply, you know, whether you get a hard copy or you read it online, read about what's happening so you understand what's going on. At the same time, on the legislative side, inform and persuade. Tell us what you think and why. And then you can have a conversation. Again, to connect to the average person. You know, President Biden has a proposal to Congress to provide free kindergarten for 2 years and also to provide free community college for 2 years. Okay. Those are policy choices. They have their merits. Oregon is providing some funding already on the community college side with the Promise program. And there's money both statewide and locally on kindergarten for the first 2 years. So here's the policy question. If President Biden and Congress pass a program providing those 2 years or that 1 year, whatever form it is, should the Oregon legislature and the governor and the executive branch take all the money that they're taking from us through our taxes and say, we're going to reduce your taxes by that amount because now we're getting the money from the federal government? Or we're going to take the money that we were putting into community college education pre-K, preschool education, and we're going to use it elsewhere. Tell us what you think and why. So it's not just simply a one-way street from the legislator to the people in the state, or from the people in the state communicating with the legislature. It's got to be an ongoing conversation, and it's got to be substantive.
So you'd say communication is the main factor, not just from the legislators down to the citizens, but the other way in establishing, you know, what is needed, what they'd like to see, and then working that out between them and remaining informed on the issues.
Meet people where they are. Most people, I'm in a fortunate position. I mean, I've worked hard, et cetera, but I've been fortunate. But most people are concerned with, okay, I want to put food on my table for my family. Okay? I want to help provide for my children and their education, so you know they can do as well or better than what I did. And if I've got aging parents, what am I going to do to be able to help them as they help their parents before? These are the, you know, if I'm going to work and I'm driving, you know, am I tied up for an hour commute? Or how do I meet the rent? How do I get a house? How do I get a mortgage? Okay, these are the questions that most people are concerned with on a day-to-day basis. You need to meet people there. And some of the stuff I've talked about is not where most people are, and I freely admit that. But you have to take what I'm saying and talk about it in terms of meeting people where they are.
Yes. Well, we both thank you for this enlightening talk. It was really insightful as to your process. And I think legislators would be well served to take your solutions to heart. So
since the three of us agree, it must be so.
I suppose so. All right. Well, thank you very much, Jeff. It was great to talk to you.
That was Jeff Goodman on how to address trade-offs in public policy. Along with a message of frugality and mindfulness about the limited resources available to legislators, Jeff calls for a renewal of what he calls the politics of persuasion. He demonstrated the effectiveness of his approach by showing how a compromise between council members led to a unanimous decision to rebuild the Lake Oswego Police Station and City Hall. He also advocates for politicians at all levels of government to reach out to their opponents in order to have open discussions about the issues before them.
Thanks again to Jeff, and thank you for tuning in. Thanks also to Kevin and Nishant for giving us the opportunity to host and hopefully not ruin their show. Be sure to let us know if you have friends, family, or acquaintances fixing interesting problems in your community. Tweet at us at @fix_cast and by using #fixer.
Finally, be sure to spread the word about Kevin and Nishant's work. It was an honor to be on the show, and we hope you'll join them next time.